Romy Hall, the protagonist of The Mars Room, is at the start of two consecutive life sentences at a women's correctional facility deep in California's Central Valley. Outside is the world from which she has been severed. Inside is a new reality. The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner is read by the author.
Let's start with basics. Do you know what year it is? It's... Doc did not know what year it was, but it dawned on him that he knew how to answer this stupid question. It's the year after last year. The doctor frowned. Do you know where you are? Doc looked around, saw nothing but a metal cart with pills in paper cups, an armed guard sitting on a chair. The room had no windows and there was nothing on the walls. He looked down at his body, saw a garment that was half a garment. His hand was plastered with tape holding a needle in. Tubes ran from his hand up to a metal stand with a bag hanging from it, half full of clear liquid. A person who must have been a nurse came in and eyed the bag, squeezed it in a way that seemed reckless, and walked out of the room. Doc's cuffed wrists were chained to the bed's metal rails. His ankles, too, were manacled to the bed rails. He had no clue where he was. All he knew was that his skull felt like it had been split in half by a concrete spillway. Icy water splashed through the spillway, pushing his brains apart.
Rachel Kushner, the author and narrator of The Mars Room. She joined me down the line via Skype and told me about the book.
The book is a contemporary novel which mostly tells the story of one young woman who speaks in the first person, although there are other characters. And it takes place in California, and in a way it's about contemporary California, but maybe a California that those outside California, and even some people who live there, don't really have to think about or see because of the way our society is so severely stratified, in that poor people who commit crimes and go to prison are almost structurally invisible to middle-class people. And this book starts with a woman who is on a bus traveling up a long stretch of highway from Los Angeles to the Central Valley, where we grow food in California. It's all industrial farming, and that's also where all the prisons are sited. And she's on her way to prisons to serve a life sentence. And as the book unfolds, she adjusts to living life in prison, and also provides the reader with significant flashbacks of material to her earlier life in San Francisco, where she grew up.
How was the research, and how was it as a writer inhabiting that character who was serving life without the possibility of parole?
Yeah, it was intense. I do a lot of volunteer work with people who are serving life sentences in prison, and that's partly how this book evolved, was that it had a natural dialogue with my actual life. And things I'm involved with separate from writing to do with, you know, I go and watch trials because I want to see who's being subjected to the justice system, who has a lawyer, who doesn't. I live right near the courts. And I did start to wonder about what happens. You know, the court is a very public place. Anyone can go and watch a trial. But once a person is convicted, they are remanded. That's the term they use, remanded to state prison. And after that, the portion of their punishment that is unseen by the public begins. And I really wanted to follow one person on that bus and up through and into prison. And because I know people who are serving life sentences and have, you know, regular dialogues with these people, I have some sense of what it's like for them. But it's a different thing to speak in the voice of someone who's experiencing that. And I wanted to force myself to do it, partly to think into what a life sentence is. It's my character doesn't have life without possibility of parole, but she has effectively that. She has two life sentences, which means you carry out the first one and you go up for parole. And if they say you've completed your sentence, then you can begin your second sentence. And it's based on a sentence that a friend of mine actually does have, a friend who has nothing to do with the character in the book. It's just a sentence. which I found sort of galling and incredible as a sentence. I did want to think into what that means. It's quite abstract to be told that the unit of your life is the segment of time that you can use to pay back the state for the harm you've committed. And it's purely subjective, because you could live for 4 years or you could live for 40 years, but that's the amount of time you need to use to give to them in order to recalibrate your wrong and make right. I mean, I don't think that they even look at it so schematically, but effectively, that's what it is. You pay back with your time, which is the only thing a lot of people have. But in writing the book, there were a lot of parts of it where mentally I wasn't inside prison, just as I assumed my character would not be, because once you go to prison, the period of life of your life where you're collecting experiences and memories from the outside world have ceased. And so I assumed it would be a time of revisiting and ruminating on those experiences, and also recounting for the reader who you are. And who you are is shaped by what happened to you before you go to prison. And people hold on to that very strongly. You know, the identity that they have is one that they've managed to acquire before they caught a case and were forced to be stripped of their identity, as the sociologist Irving Goffman would put it, you know, have their clothes taken away from them, all the things that signify a life in particularity. So she goes back in her memories and provides chapters of her childhood and adolescence in San Francisco, and then the years directly before she went to prison in Los Angeles. So that was just all kind of normal writing in a way for me, because I was telling the story of a character, and she was in a milieu that I know very well. I know it personally. She's from my neighborhood where I grew up, and her friends are, it's essentially a world that I lived. Her friends are my friends. So it wasn't that exotic for me, but also I know people from growing up who went to prison. And so in a way, the book gave me the opportunity, even if it was very dark at times, to sort out some of what happened in terms of the stark distance between different destinies. You know, when you're a child, you're at least for me as an adolescent, the world of my friends was everything. I barely saw my parents. Much as I love them, they weren't involved. I was just with this group of kids. And even when you're young, there's a feeling that people are going to go in different directions. And there were people who, you know, made a courageous stance that their life was going to be about pushing back against authority. And some of that has to do with their home life. And, you know, I had a couple of friends, or many friends, who were lost to that. And one in particular who went to prison. And the difference between what happened in his life and what happened in mine, that is painful for me, but writing the book was a way somehow of processing some of those differences and that pain. But I also tried to make it a very funny book, and that's not just to include humor and entertain people, although I do hope it does that, but because I felt like I wouldn't have been getting at the truth of the matter if I didn't find the humor. Because it's just not all misery and crying all the time. People are very funny and resourceful in prison. It's a very lively place. And I think there are reasons for that. Like, your personality is one of the only forms of currency you have in prison, since everything is taken away from you. Some people have money on their books, you know, to shop at the canteen. Many people don't. They have their ability to cajole and persuade and seduce and entertain and threaten and manipulate. So personality is a premium. And I've found people to be incredibly funny. In my own life, the people I knew who were always getting arrested and having to deal with the criminal justice system, and the people I know who are there now, there's always room for humor. I mean, even as your options reduce down, then that becomes your life. And there are people who are still willing to insult a cop to get a few laughs out of their peers, even if it means getting thrown into administrative segregation. And so I needed to tap into that kind of humor. It was really important to me, because if I wasn't doing it, I wasn't tapping into the truth of the place.
Yeah, I like the description of the actual Mars room. If you showered, you had a competitive edge. If your tattoos weren't misspelled, you were hot property.
Oh, well, yeah, that's the club that she worked at. It's actually kind of based on a place in San Francisco that doesn't exist anymore that was very much like that. Like, the girls who worked there always thought John Waters should come and film a movie there because he could find a natural set of characters.
Now, you narrated the audio version of the book. How was that process?
It was really fun. I really wanted to do it. I hadn't narrated my previous two books. There's something about the delivery of a professional narrator that's just quite different than the delivery of an author. And probably there are people out there who prefer the professional narrators. It's very slick and smooth, and they change intonation when they speak from the voice of a different character. But I like things read by the author if the author is a good reader. I felt with this book like I really wanted to do the narration, partly because over the last year that I was editing it, I was reading sentences out loud because the sentences are somewhat vocal. They're short, they're syncopated, they're declarative. Romy has a kind of tough tone. And I knew how each line should be delivered. I mean, at least by me, if I were narrating, I felt like I could do it. And almost like I was inadvertently practicing as I was editing the text, because when you read out loud, you can really see what's extraneous and how the rhythm and the syntax is working. So I asked if I could narrate, and they hemmed and hawed and considered me, and finally they agreed. And it was really fun to do, strangely. I didn't realize that they have you read on a Kindle, which I'd never held an electronic book in my hand before. But it makes perfect sense for that format because you don't have to stop and flip pages. You're just in this seamless river of text that you move lightly with your fingers and it makes no noise. And you take a break when you want to, and they have an audiobook producer and a sound engineer there. And they listened to it. I never had to listen to it, but they were quite fun to work with. And I think I'd practiced so much that I didn't really have to do any retakes. So it was actually easy. It was fun to do.
And along with the audiobook, there are accessible versions. It's available also in Braille and in giant print.
It's incredibly lucky for authors to have their books repackaged in ways that can reach different audiences. It's amazing that you do it in Braille. I actually was just with my cousin last week who has lost the sight in one eye and may lose the sight in his other eye, but he's already feeling like he can't really read with monocular vision. And also I grew up with a grandmother who had polio and had a disability and was a tireless activist for disability rights in the 1960s, 50s and 60s, very early. So by the 70s, when I was a child, I was used to this kind of group of campaigners that she had aligned herself with. And it was really her life's work, in a way, to make disability rights front and center. She was in a wheelchair. And so accessibility of many different kinds is hugely important to me. You know, it's an ongoing struggle in our life to be more aware ourselves and to make other people more aware of what ableism is and who's being excluded.
Rachel Kushner, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thank you so much for having me and for your questions.